Welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002, Houston's community station, 90.1 FM and FM HD1. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1079, I will have two segments. First, I will speak with Rania Sukkar, Syrian-American CEO of Intuit MailChimp and co-founder of Jusur, a global nonprofit that has provided education opportunities to over 10,000 Syrian children and youth and has impacted the lives of thousands more. Rania Sukkar is the recipient of the 2023 Outstanding Arab American Philanthropist of the Year Award by the Center for Arab American Philanthropy, and I will be speaking with her about that award, her organization, Jusur, and her work with Syrian youth and refugees. During the second segment, and on the 20th anniversary of the passing of the late Palestinian scholar, writer, author, activist, and intellectual, Professor Edward Said, I will air a portion of one of his last major speeches on dignity and solidarity. During the previous episode of Arab Voices, I talked about the deadly earthquake in Morocco and flooding in Libya that killed thousands of people and caused catastrophic impacts on both countries. I would like to mention again ways you can assist, especially as we are learning now that both disasters are much worse than originally thought. There are various ways you can assist by donating to various organizations that are aiding the rescue and recovery efforts in Morocco and Libya. One of them is the Center for Arab American Philanthropy in the United States, which established a community's collective response for disaster relief fund for both Libya and Morocco. I have more information on that, as well as other organizations that are accepting donations, including the Moroccan American Society in Houston, on our website arabvoices.net under the community calendar section. The Center for Arab American Philanthropy has chosen Rania Sukkar to be the recipient of the 2023 Outstanding Arab American Philanthropist of the Year Award. Rania Sukkar is a Syrian American, lifelong social entrepreneur, and an accomplished business leader. She is the CEO of Intuit MailChimp. Before that, she was Google's Director of Brand Solutions for North America and has worked for McKinsey in the US and Dubai before joining Google. Rania co-founded the Harvard Arab Alumni Association in 2001 and was president until 2008. She has a Harvard MBA, a Harvard MPA in International Development, and a Harvard BA in Economics. Rania is passionate about closing the opportunity gap that exists for children and youth in the Arab world. In 2011, she co-founded Jusur, an Arabic word meaning bridges, a global non-profit that has provided education opportunities to over 10,000 Syrian children and youth and has impacted the lives of thousands more. Rania Sukkar is joining us via phone. Rania, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you for having me, Saeed.
It's good to have you with us, and congratulations on getting the 2023 Outstanding Arab American Philanthropist of the Year Award.
Thank you. It's a tremendous honor.
Could you start by telling our listeners a bit more about yourself, like where were you born and raised, before we talk more about Jusur and the work it has been doing?
Yes. I was born in Michigan. My parents immigrated from Syria in the early 70s, and so my siblings and I were born here. And we had the fortune of growing up really with tremendous exposure to two beautiful cultures, the culture here in the U.S., which we were fortunate to grow up living in, and also the culture of Syria and the richness that comes with the culture in the Arab world, whether it was the close family ties or the beautiful history. And so I grew up navigating those two cultures.
Was it a tough road for you from the time you grew up until you received your degrees from Harvard University as an Arab American?
I always felt that having a strong culture exposure to a different culture and a strong identity helped me in life. I never felt that it held me back. It was, you know, I grew up in an environment where we had many different cultures represented in the schools that I attended and in the neighborhoods we lived in. And so it was celebrated. We celebrated people of each of their different cultures and religious backgrounds. And so for me, I always saw it as an asset growing up rather than a disadvantage.
Absolutely. And there are so many stories of Arab Americans contributing to the society here, contributing to the United States tremendously in all aspects of life. And we are going to highlight your work and what you have been doing over the years, especially with Jusur. So now if you could tell us about this organization that you co-founded back in 2011, that's called Jusur. Tell us more about it and the work that it does.
Yes. You know, the reason behind Jusur, I mentioned we used to spend our summers in Damascus growing up. And as I used to spend my summers in Damascus growing up, I began to see the opportunity gap that existed in Syria, in the Arab world. I saw it because when I was younger and would visit, my cousins and I had all the same ambitions in the world. And by the time we became teenagers, things had changed dramatically. For us living in the U.S., our dreams were just through the roof and very significant. Meanwhile, for my cousins in Syria, their ambitions had dwindled quite a bit because there was very little to hope for. There were very few opportunities in that economy. So the younger, the women would get married at very early ages, and then the boys stopped going to university because there was no payoff from going to university. And I became very passionate about finding ways to close that opportunity gap where people in that part of the world could have all the same opportunities we did. So that idea stayed in my mind. And several years later, I was fortunate to meet several other young Syrians who'd grown up all over the world, who'd lived all over the world, whether it was in the Middle East, in Dubai, for example, or in Europe or in Canada. And we each shared a similar determination to see Syria and the Arab world realize its full potential. And so we got together and we said, let's create an organization that is focused on helping close that opportunity gap. And we narrowed in on education as the most important lever we could invest in. The idea was that even though there were so many needs right now, especially in Syria, given the ongoing war and conflict that's been going on, that if we invested in education, that would be the greatest way to help transform the current trajectory for the country. And so we did that. We formed an organization 12 years ago. And since then, we have now helped educate 15,000 young people through the organization. And it's a combination of scholarships. We do university scholarships in countries around the world. It's a combination of our refugee education program in Lebanon and around the region where we help young children who otherwise wouldn't know how to read or write. We help them with basic literacy and a primary education. And it's also an entrepreneurship program where we give students the skills that they need to thrive as entrepreneurs. So the common theme is we're focused on investing in Syria's youth for a brighter tomorrow in order to help the country realize its potential.
An absolutely outstanding and great investment in the Syrian youth. So is the work towards, are you targeting Syrian refugees in different countries in the Middle East? And I know there are a lot of Syrian refugees also here in the United States. And does it include Syrians also inside Syria? Or what countries do you all assist Syrians with?
Well, ultimately, as I mentioned, we're trying to close the opportunity gap. We're trying to prevent a lost generation for Syria. And so it's all about identifying the youth who are going to benefit most. All of the categories you mentioned are part of our target audience, but we think very hard about which programs to invest in based on where we're going to have the greatest impact. And the way we measure impact is how much will the individuals that we educate be able to make a difference in the world around them? We look for the multiplier effect. We say if this individual were to receive a scholarship from us, Will they go on in their life to want to drive transformational change? Will they ultimately found their own nonprofit organization or do tremendously important research that's going to aid the region in development or go on and, you know, work in a media field, for example, that's going to help raise critical awareness? So we look for the ability of our recipients to make transformational change for our society in general and for Syria and the Arab world in particular. And that's how we evaluate different programs to invest in and specific individuals to invest in. We also try to help the host countries where we do work. So as I mentioned, we do a lot of work in Lebanon. We also do some work in Jordan. Those are countries that also struggle with their own challenges. And so when we work in a host country, we work to ensure that our programs support both the host country as well as the refugee population living in that country.
And I noticed on your website that I guess that's a goal for your organization. Says, quote, changing the lives of 1 million Syrian youth by 2031. An ambitious mission, definitely. Tell us more about that and the road to that.
Well, I'm very proud of how we built Jasur and how we run Jasur. It's not your traditional nonprofit organization. As I shared at the beginning, it was founded by several individuals who are mostly involved in the private sector, different fields of the private sector, lawyers, business people, technologists, people in media, investing in venture capital. But because we have a very different background than a traditional nonprofit, we run Jasur differently. In many ways, we run it like a private organization. We run it to drive tremendous efficiency in how we deploy funds. We're constantly pushing to increase our impact every year as a private sector company would be pushed to do. And so when you hear a goal like a million recipients impacted by 2031, it's all based on the idea that we want to 10x our impact every year over time, constantly look for new levers to innovate and drive significant change. And so with each of our programs between now and, you know, a decade from now, it's all about looking at how do you dramatically increase the impact? If today we're delivering our refugee education programs in in-person classrooms, how do we scale that dramatically through technology and online capabilities? If we are doing our scholarship program today and helping hundreds of students each year, how do we dramatically increase that by strengthening our partnership network around the world? So those are the questions we ask and the type of impact we try to have, given the way in which we built Jasur and the impact we aspire to have.
And obviously, your organization, Jasur, is non-political, non-governmental organization that relies, I'm assuming, heavily on individual donors to fund its work and to provide scholarships for students?
Yes, that's right. We have a very active giving program, and we receive funds and donations from individuals from all backgrounds. It includes individual donations. They can be small. They can be large. It includes grants from giving bodies for various work that we do. It includes corporate giving as well. So we very actively work to engage the global population that's interested in this cause and supporting this work. And it's enabled us to continue doing this very meaningful work, whether it's funding an individual student to learn to read and get a basic education in Lebanon, which could be, for example, $50 a month, or funding an entire classroom for a month where you fund the teacher's education. And our teachers tend to be refugees themselves. And so when you fund a teacher, it's like a triple investment. You're investing in the training of that teacher and maintaining the skills that the Syrian labor force will need in the future, so you don't have that lack of skills left in the country. You fund the student's education, and then the teacher's salary goes back into the refugee community to help them survive and exist. So anyway, there's so many ways that individuals can donate and give, and corporations can give, and grant-making bodies can give. And people have found the work to be very meaningful and impactful over time. We've been working to continue to raise more and more funds every year to be able to achieve the goals we've set out for ourselves.
Absolutely noble and great cause. Could you share the website for your organization with our listeners, for those who are interested in learning more about Jasur?
I typically Google Jasur Syria, and it comes up at the top of my list of searches. So that's the way I typically get to it.
Very well. And I will have a link to Jusur on our website, arabvoices.net. As an Arab American, a very successful woman professionally in your philanthropy work and all the stuff that you have been doing over the years, which is tremendous, what message would you give to Arab Americans in general, women, youth, to guide them in being on the road to success and to excel in their endeavors?
Well, the main message I'd love to leave the community with is that the people in the Arab world need us. There's never been a time where there's been more challenges present. And the thing I've been blown away by with Jusur is that it is possible as individuals to make absolutely transformational change. The fact that with Jusur, we've given 15,000 young people the gift of a direct education, but even more than that, we've created hope for thousands more who see their peers and people just like them having been able to be successful and realize their dreams. We've been able to create hope for so many more. So when I see something like this, I recognize that we can make a difference. Sometimes you look at something as challenging as the situation in the Arab world, and you feel like there's nothing that can be done, and it can be debilitating. But this is an example that we can drive significant change. So the main message I would leave everyone with is find a way to get involved. Stay hopeful. Stay optimistic. Stay creative in terms of what that intervention and solution can look like. And together, we can drive positive change for the Arab world.
Well, Arab Americans, men and women, have contributed significantly to the United States in all aspects of life over so many years, and to the Middle East, Europe, and globally. And a great example is Rania Sukkar, our guest today on Arab Voices, who has been an inspiration not just to women, but to everyone. Congratulations again, Rania, on all your accomplishments over the years, and congratulations on being awarded the 2023 Outstanding Arab American Philanthropist of the Year Award.
Thank you so much, Saeed, and thanks for having me.
Thank you, Rania Sukkar, Syrian-American CEO of Intuit MailChimp, co-founder of Jusur, and the recipient of the 2023 Outstanding Arab American Philanthropist of the Year Award by the Center for Arab American Philanthropy. Thank you so much, Rania. We greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. I'll take a break now, and when we come back, we will listen to a portion of one of the last major speeches delivered by the late Palestinian scholar, activist, and intellectual Professor Edward Said on dignity and solidarity.
لابد لنا من أن نتذكر بين الحين والآخر صبرا وشتيلة. صبرا فتاة نائمة رحل الرجال إلى الرحيل والحرب نامت ليلتين صغيرتين وقدمت بيروت طاعتها وصارت عاصمة ليل طويل يرصد الأحلام في صبرا وصبرا نائمة صبر بقايا الكف في جسد قتيل ودعت فرسانها وزمانها واستسلمت للنوم من تعب ومن عرب رموها خلفه صبرا وما ينسى الجنود الراحلون من الجليل لا تشتري وتبيع إلا صمتها من أجل ورد بالضفير صبرا تغني نصفها المفقود بين البحر والحرب الأخيرة لما ترحلون وتتركون نساءكم في بطن ليل من حديد لما ترحلون وتعلقون مساءكم فوق المخيم والنشيد صبرا تغطي صدرها العاري بأغنية الوداع وتعد كفيها وتخطئ حين لا تجد الذراع كم مرة ستسافرون وإلى متى ستسافرون ولأي حلم؟ وإذا رجعتم ذات يوم فلأي منفى ترجعون؟ صبرا تمزق صدرها المكشوف، كم مرة تتفتح الزهرة، كم مرة ستسافر الثورة؟ صبرا تخاف، صبرا تخاف الليل، تسنده لركبتها، تغطيه بكحل عيونها، تبكي لتلهيه. رحلوا وما قالوا شيئا عن العودة، عادوا وما عادوا في بداية الرحلة، والعمر أولاد هربوا من القبة. لا، ليس لي منفى لأقول لي وطن. صبرا تنام وخنجر الفاشي يصحو، صبرا تنادي من تنادي، كل هذا الليل لي والليل ملح. يقطع الفاشي ثدييها، يقل الليل، يرقص حول خنجره ويلعق، يغني لانتصار الأرز موالا، ويمحو في هدوء، في هدوء لحمها عن عظمها، ويمدد الأعضاء فوق الطاولة، ويواصل الفاشي رقصته ويضحك للعيون المائلة ويجن من فرح. صبرا لم تعد جسدا، يركبها كما شاءت غرائزه وتصنعها مشيئته، ويسرق خاتما من لحمها ويعود من دمها إلى مرآته، ويكون بحر ويكون بر ويكون غيم ويكون دم ويكون ليل ويكون قتل ويكون سبت، وتكون صبرا. صبرا تقاطع شارعين على جسد، صبرا نزول الروح في حجر، وصبرا لا أحد، صبرا هوية عصرنا حتى الأبد.
That was Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish with a poem on Sabra and Shatila, two Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, where Israel committed a massacre in the camps, killing thousands of Palestinian men, women, children, and elderly in September 1982. Welcome back to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This week marks the 20th anniversary of the passing of Professor Edward Said, and on this occasion I will air a portion of one of his last major speeches. Edward Said was born in Jerusalem in 1935 to a Christian Arab family. His father immigrated to the United States at the turn of the century. Said was raised in Jerusalem and Cairo. In 1951, he went to the United States to attend Princeton and Harvard universities. He specialized in English literature, comparative literature, and musicology. He was appointed professor at Columbia University in New York City, where he stayed for the rest of his life. He died on September 25, 2003, in New York. For more than a decade, Said battled leukemia, but never stopped writing a great deal on the Palestinian-Israeli subject, choosing to participate in conferences and speak out with the vehemence that characterized him. Professor Edward Said is an internationally renowned writer, author, and scholar. His writings about the Middle East and its relationship with the West have gone far to open new roads in academia and to influence public opinion. During the course of his life, Professor Said articulated a vision of Palestine and the Arab world that not only recalled the significant contributions of the region's people, but also offered hope for the future. On the 20th anniversary of his passing, and in memory and honor of Dr. Edward Said, I am going to air now a portion of a speech he delivered on dignity and solidarity at the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee's annual convention held in Washington, D.C. in June 2003, 3 months before he died.
The title of my talk today is called On Dignity and Solidarity. In early May of this year, I was in Seattle lecturing for a few days. While there, I had dinner one night with Rachel Corey's parents and sister, who I think are here. In fact, I saw them. Where are they? Could you stand up, please? I'm going to speak impressionistically, Craig, and because I felt you were still reeling from the shock of your daughter's murder on March the 16th in Gaza by an Israeli bulldozer. Mr. Corey told me that he himself had driven bulldozers, although the one that killed his daughter deliberately because she was trying valiantly to protect the Palestinian home in Rafah from demolition was not an ordinary Caterpillar bulldozer, but a 60-ton behemoth, specially designed by Caterpillar. And there's a project right there, you know, to demonstrate and prevent as many of these Caterpillar special house demolishing caterpillars from ever getting there. So a mass action that as Americans we can do. They're specially designed to destroy homes. They have no other purpose. And it's a far bigger machine, he said, than anything he had ever seen or driven. Two things struck me about my brief visit with the Coreys. One was the story they told me about their return to the U.S. after their daughter's funeral. They had immediately sought out their U.S. senators, Patty Murray and Mary Cantwell, who are both Democrats, told them their story, and received the expected expressions of shock, outrage, anger, and promises of investigations. After both senators returned to Washington, the Coreys, at least when I saw them in May, never heard from them again, and the promised investigation hasn't yet materialized, although there is talk about it, and there is talk that the senators are working behind the scenes to do something. As expected, the Israeli lobby had explained the realities to them, and both senators simply begged off. An American citizen was willfully murdered by the soldiers of a client state of the United States, using a United States-built instrument of death, a terrorist instrument, without so much as an official peep or even the routine investigation that had been promised her family. But the second and far more important aspect of the Rachel Corey story for me was the young woman's action itself, heroic and dignified at the same time. Born, she grew up in Olympia, a city 60 miles south of Seattle, and she had joined the international solidarity movement, gone to Gaza to stand with suffering human beings with whom she had never had any contact before. Her letters back to her family are truly remarkable documents of her ordinary humanity that make for very difficult and moving reading, especially when she describes the kindness and concern shown her by all the Palestinians she encounters, who clearly welcome her as one of their own, because she lives with them exactly as they do, sharing their lives and worries, as well as the horrors of the Israeli occupation and its terrible effects on even the smallest child. She understands the fate of the refugees and what she calls the Israeli government's insidious attempt at a kind of genocide by making it almost impossible for this particular group of individuals to survive. Those are her words. So moving is her solidarity that it inspires an Israeli reservist called Danny, who has refused service in the Israeli army, to write her and tell her, and I quote from the letters, "You are doing a good thing. I thank you for it." What shines through all the letters she wrote home and which were subsequently published in the London Guardian is the amazing resistance put up by the Palestinian people themselves, average human beings put in the most terrible position of suffering and despair, but continuing to survive and stay on just the same. We've heard so much recently about the roadmap and the prospects for peace that we seem to have overlooked the most basic fact of all, which is that Palestinians have refused to capitulate or surrender even under the collective punishment meted out to them by the combined might of Israel and the United States. It is that fact, that extraordinary fact of Palestinian resistance, which is the reason for the existence of a roadmap and all the numerous so-called peace plans before them. Not at all because the United States and Israel and the international community have been convinced for humanitarian reasons that the killing and the violence must stop. If we miss that truth about the power of Palestinian resistance, despite all its failings and all its mistakes, and God knows there have been many, we miss everything. Palestinians have always been a problem for the Zionist project, and many solutions have perennially been proposed that minimize rather than solve the problem. The official Israeli policy, no matter what, whether Ariel Sharon uses the word occupation or not, or whether or not he dismantles a rusty, unused tower or two, has always been not to accept the reality of the Palestinian people as equals, nor even to admit that their rights were scandalously violated all along by Israel. Whereas a few courageous Israelis over the years have tried to deal with this other concealed history, most Israelis and what seems like the majority of Americans, of American Jews, have made every effort to deny, avoid, or negate the Palestinian reality. That is why there is no peace. Moreover, the roadmap, as I told the secretary yesterday, the roadmap says nothing about justice or about the historical punishment meted out to the Palestinian people for too many decades to count. What Rachel Corrie's work in Gaza recognized, however, was precisely the gravity and the density of the living history of the Palestinian people as a national community and not merely a collection of deprived refugees. That is what she was in solidarity with. And I want to remind you that that kind of solidarity is no longer confined to a small number of intrepid souls here and there, but is recognized the world over. 5 years ago, Rachel Corrie would not have gone to Palestine. She wouldn't perhaps have heard about it. Now, the situation has changed. In the past 6 months, I have lectured in four continents to many, many thousands of people. What brings them together is Palestine and the struggle of the Palestinian people, which is now a byword for emancipation and enlightenment, regardless of all the vilification heaped on them by their enemies. Whenever the facts are made known, there is immediate recognition and an expression of the most profound solidarity with the justice of the Palestinian cause and the valiant struggle by the Palestinian people on its behalf. It's an extraordinary thing that Palestine this year was a central issue both during the Porto Alegre anti-globalization meetings in Brazil as well as during the Davos meetings at both ends of the worldwide political spectrum. Just because our fellow citizens in this country are fed an atrociously biased diet of ignorance and misrepresentation by the media, when the occupation is never referred to in lurid descriptions of suicide attacks, The apartheid wall, which is 25 feet high, 5 feet thick, and 350 kilometers long that Israel is building is never shown on CNN and the networks, or so much as referred to in passing throughout the lifeless prose of the roadmap. And the crimes of war, the gratuitous destruction and humiliation, the maimings, the house demolitions, agricultural destruction and death imposed on Palestinian civilians are never shown for the daily, completely routine ordeal that they are. One shouldn't be surprised that Americans, in the main, have a very low opinion of Arabs and the Palestinians. After all, please remember that all the main organs of the main establishment, of the establishment medium, from left liberal all the way over to fringe right, are unanimously anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, and anti-Palestinian. Look at the pusillanimity of the media during the build-up to the illegal and unjust war against Iraq, and look at how little coverage there was of the immense damage against Iraqi society done by the 12-year sanctions, and how relatively few accounts, journalistic accounts there were, of the immense worldwide outpouring of opinion against the war. Hardly a single journalist, except Helen Thomas, who's an Arab American, has taken the administration to task for the outrageous lies and confected facts that were spun out about Iraq as an imminent military threat to the United States before the war. Just as now the same government propagandists who cynically invented and manipulated facts about weapons of mass destruction are now more or less forgotten or shrugged off as irrelevant, they're let off the hook by media heavies in discussing the awful, the literally inexcusable situation for the people of Iraq that the United States has now single-handedly and irresponsibly created there. However else one blames Saddam Hussein as the vicious tyrant that he was, he had provided the people of Iraq with the best infrastructure of services like water, electricity, health, and education of any Arab country. None of this is any longer in place. It's no wonder, then, that with the extraordinary fear of seeming anti-Semitic by criticizing Israel for its daily crimes of war against innocent, unarmed Palestinian civilians, or criticizing the U.S. government and being called anti-American for its illegal war and its dreadfully run military occupation, that the vicious media and government campaign against Arab society, culture, history, and mentality, to say nothing of the campaign against Arab Americans and Muslim Americans in this country, has been led by Neanderthal publicists and Orientalists like Daniel Pipes and Bernard Lewis. This has cowed far too many of us into believing that Arabs really are an underdeveloped, incompetent, and doomed people, and that with all the failures in democracy and development, Arabs are alone in this world for being retarded, being behind the times, unmodernized, and deeply reactionary. Here is where dignity and critical historical thinking must be mobilized to see what is what, and to disentangle truth from propaganda. No one would deny that most Arab countries today are ruled by unpopular regimes, and that vast numbers of poorly disadvantaged young Arabs are exposed to the ruthless forms of fundamentalist religion. Yet it is simply a lie to say, as the New York Times, in its editorials and in its news reporting, regularly say, that Arab societies are, quote-unquote, totally controlled, and that there is no freedom of opinion, no civil institutions, no functioning social movements for and by the people. Press laws notwithstanding, you can go to downtown Amman today and buy a Communist Party newspaper there, as well as an Islamist one. Egypt and Lebanon are full of papers and journals that suggest much more debate and discussion than these societies are given credit for. The satellite channels are bursting with diverse opinions in a dizzying variety. Civil institutions are, on many levels, having to do with social services, human rights, syndicates, women's rights, and research institutes, very lively all over the Arab world. In Palestine alone, there are over 1,000 NGOs, and it is this vitality and this kind of activity that has kept society going, despite every American and Israeli effort made to vilify, stop, or mutilate it on a daily basis. And if you compare, as I think it's salutary to do, the American media and its reporting, especially the leading newspapers like the Post here or the New York Times on the op-ed page or Fox or CNN, you compare those with the satellite, the Arab satellite channels or the newspapers that one can read, you know, published in London, published in Beirut, published in Cairo, etc. I mean, who are we kidding? The range of opinion is much greater in the Arab world than it is here. They've sold us. This propaganda campaign has made even Arabs believe the lies about them that, of course, are being put out by people who wish them no good but want to portray them as sort of retarded, you know, primitives who are basically trivial and sort of out of it in general. Under the worst possible circumstances, Palestinian society has neither been defeated nor has it crumbled completely. And this is, of course, Sharon's predicament. Kids still go to school. Doctors and nurses still take care of their patients. Men and women go to work, organizations have their meetings, and people continue to live. Which seems to be an offense to Sharon and the other extremists who simply want Palestinians either imprisoned or driven away altogether. The military solution that they've tried hasn't worked at all and never will work. Why is that so hard for Israelis and Americans to see? So I want to suggest that it's our role to help them to understand this, not by suicide bombers, but by rational argument, mass civil disobedience, by organized protest here and everywhere. The point I'm trying to make is that we have to see the Arab world generally, and Palestine in particular, in more comparative and critical ways than silly books like Bernard Lewis's What Went Wrong and Paul Wolfowitz's ignorant statements about bringing democracy to the he should bring democracy to the Pentagon. I mean, that's just not that. His arguments about bringing democracy to the Arab and Islamic world can even begin to suggest whatever else is true about the Arabs. There is an active dynamic at work because as real people, they live in a real society, not in some, you know, daydream or a wet dream invented by Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle, with all sorts of currents and countercurrents in it that can't easily be caricatured as just one seething mass of violent fanaticism. The Palestinian struggle for justice is especially something with which one expresses solidarity, rather than endless criticism and dismissive, frustrating discouragement and crippling divisiveness. Remember the solidarity shown towards Palestine here and everywhere in Latin America, Africa, Europe, Asia, and Australia. And remember also that there is a cause to which, a real cause, to which many people have committed themselves, difficulties and terrible obstacles notwithstanding. Why? Because it is a just cause, a noble ideal, a moral quest for equality and human rights. I want now to speak about dignity, which of course has a special place in every culture known to historians, anthropologists, sociologists, and humanists. I shall begin by saying immediately that it is a radically wrong orientalist and indeed racist proposition to accept the fact or the notion or the theory that unlike Europeans and Americans, Arabs, and we're told this all the time in the media, Arabs have no sense of individuality, they have no regard for individual life, no values that express love and intimacy and understanding that are supposed to be the exclusive property of cultures like those of Europe and America that had a Renaissance, a Reformation, and Enlightenment. Among many others, it is the vulgar and jejune Thomas Friedman who has been peddling this absolute rubbish, which has all, alas, been picked up not by many other Americans, and this is the sad part of it, but by equally ignorant and self-deceiving Arab intellectuals. I don't need to mention any names here, who have seen in the atrocities of 9/11 a sign that the Arab and Islamic worlds are somehow more diseased and more dysfunctional than any other, and that terrorism is a sign of a wider distortion than has occurred in any other culture. We can leave to one side the slightly inconvenient fact that between them, Europe and the United States account for 80% of the violent deaths of the 20th century. I mean, that's just a little unimportant fact. The Islamic world in those conflicts hardly provided a fraction of that damage. And behind all that specious, unscientific nonsense about wrong and right civilizations, there is the grotesque shadow of the great false prophet Samuel Huntington, who has led a lot of people to believe that the world can be divided into distinct civilizations battling against each other forever. On the contrary, Huntington is dead wrong on every point he makes. No culture or civilization exists by itself. None is made up of things like individuality and enlightenment that are completely exclusive to it, and none exists without the basic human attributes of community, love, value for life, and all the others. Even Arabs have those things in their culture. To suggest otherwise, as he does in his is the purest invidious racism of the same stripe as people who used to argue that Africans have naturally inferior brains, or that Asians are really born for servitude, or that Europeans are a naturally superior race. This is a sort of parody of Hitlerian science directed uniquely today against Arabs and Muslims, and we must be very firm as not even going through the motions of arguing against it. It is the purest drivel. On the other hand, there is the much more credible and serious stipulation that, like every other instance of humanity, Arabs and Arab and Muslim life has an inherent value and dignity which are expressed by Arabs and Muslims in their unique cultural style, and those expressions needn't resemble or be a copy of one approved model certified by Richard Perle, suitable for everyone. The whole point about human diversity is that it is in the end a form of deep coexistence between very different forms of individuality and experience that can't all be reduced to one superior form that we should all follow, you know. And that's behind this absolutely ridiculous, this hubristic, arrogant idea that somehow America has gone to Iraq to liberate the Iraqis and show them the true way. I mean, who gave them that authority? What illumination came down on President Bush who can barely get himself onto a golf course, This is the spurious argument foisted on us by pundits all over the mainstream media who bewail the lack of development and knowledge in the Arab world. And alas, it's been picked up by the United Nations in that Arab Human Development Report, which is full of the most immature and puerile generalizations about how many books are translated. For example, they say 300 books have been translated in the Arab world only. Well, how many books have been translated from other languages into America? Only 300, and this is the most powerful, the richest, the most developed culture in the world. If you ask how many books from Arabic have been translated into English, I'll tell you what the figure is in this country. It's 13 books in the last 4 years. That shows how advanced America is, right? And these are the figures that this report bandies about, so that more Arabs feel, oh yeah, we're terrible, we're really behind everybody, and we really have to take it on the chin, and we have to blame ourselves. As some guy I saw on television say, it's a wake-up call for the Arab world. As if the Arab world has been asleep waiting for this guy to wake it up. My God. All one has to do, if one has the sense, is to look at the huge variety of literature, of cinema, of theater, of painting, of music, and popular culture produced by and for Arabs from Morocco to the Gulf. Surely that needs to be assessed. And let me, in this connection, mention something that I'm sure most of you don't even know about. Under the worst possible conditions, you know, on the West Bank, Ramallah is a city under siege most of the time. There are curfews. You know, people can't get from one town to another, one part of a town to the other. There's always the fear of getting picked up by the Israelis and detained. There are 5,000 Palestinian prisoners now held onto without charge by the Israelis. In spite of all this, and the bombings, and the house demolitions, etc., there is now a flourishing Palestinian music conservatory where hundreds of eager kids come for piano lessons and violin lessons and clarinet lessons and cello lessons under fire to teachers who give of their time and of their gifts freely. And now this is spread all over the West Bank, not just in Ramallah, but there is a branch in Jerusalem, there's one in Bethlehem, and so on and so forth. Really, this is here's a recording made by a group from the Conservatory of Arabic Music, a CD. Here is the account of it, and here's some leaflets, which will be available at the back of the hall for you to look at. And I recommend it's, you know, a very worthwhile, humane project to support. It's precisely this kind of thing that never gets mentioned. They just talk about suicide bombers, right? That Palestinian kids are very gifted, that there is a marvelously accomplished young Palestinian pianist who's now playing at the best halls all over the world, that there's another one who's only 13 or 14 years old who's considered to be a child prodigy, all of them having connections with this conservatory. That's never mentioned. It's only we're suicide bombers and fundamentalists. So fine, it was an excellent thing that Saddam Hussein's appalling regime is no more. Who could fight with that? Who could disagree? But who appointed the U.S. to be the Arab mentor, to be almost the Arab nanny? Who asked the United States to take over the Arab world, allegedly on behalf of its citizens, and bring it something called democracy, especially a time when in our own country, in America, the school system, the health system, and the whole economy are degenerating into the worst level since the 1929 Depression? Where is the domestic, the diplomatic and political and economic support necessary to sustain an anti-occupation movement on the West Bank and Gaza? Instead, all one hears is that foreign ministers preach to the Palestinians to mind their ways, avoid violence, and keep at the peace negotiations, even though it has been so obvious that Sharon's interest in peace is just about zero. This is unimaginable, that there has been no concerted Arab response to the separation wall, or to the assassinations, or to the collective punishment. Only a bunch of tired cliches repeating the well-worn formulas authorized by the State Department. Only if we respect ourselves as Arab and Americas, finally, and understand the true dignity and justice of our struggle, only then can we appreciate why, almost despite ourselves, so many people all over the world, including Rachel Corey and the two young people wounded with her from ISM, Tom Herndahl and Brian Avery, have felt it possible to express their solidarity with us. I leave you with one last irony. Isn't it astonishing that all the signs of popular solidarity that Palestine and the Arabs receive occur with no comparable sign of solidarity and dignity for ourselves? That others admire and respect us more than we do ourselves? Isn't it time we caught up with ourselves, with our own status, and made certain that our representatives here and elsewhere realize, as a first step, that they are fighting for a just and noble cause, and that they have nothing to apologize for or anything to be embarrassed about? On the contrary, they should be proud. On the contrary, they should be proud, and we should all be proud of what our people have done, and proud also to represent them. Thank you very much.
What you just heard was a portion of a speech delivered by the late Palestinian scholar, activist, and intellectual Professor Edward Said, who passed away 20 years ago on September 25th, 2023, in New York. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Said, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.